Hey everyone, and welcome back to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. And yes, I am back from a two-week vacation. I had a lovely time. Thank you for asking. I got some city time in Brisbane with the family, then went and did some camping down the coast, even got in a surf. And yes, in typical fashion, the well and truly hit the fan the moment I clocked off. We'll be talking through the big security news of the last few weeks in just a moment with our co-host Adam Boileau. And then it'll be time for this week's sponsor interview, and this week's show is brought to you by CoreLight. CoreLight makes a network sensor based on Zeek. They're not really an IDS play so much as a network detection and response play. The NDR category is a new one from Gartner. But anyway, CoreLight's Chief Product Officer, Brian Dye, will be along for a bit of a chat later on. And we cover a few things. We look at how adopting a zero trust model, sadly, doesn't mean you can just completely ignore your network, as much as that would be lovely. That is coming up later. But first up, of course, it's time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And yeah, Adam, I've just come back in from the wilderness. Did I miss much?
Well, we got all sorts of things going on. There's things blowing up and there's things getting burnt down and there's, you know, bugs are plenty. Yeah, it's been a bit of a ride while you're away.
It did get a bit hectic. I must admit to half following along while I was on break. Like I'd check the Twitters every now and then and just go, wow, you know, sort of pick up the phone for 2 minutes and just go, then put it down and get on with my day. Obviously, we're not going to be able to cover everything that happened in the last 3 weeks. But geez, I mean, even just when you pick the big stuff, there was quite a lot of that. I want to start with this indictment. The United States has indicted two guys who apparently were like freelance contract hackers doing missions for the Chinese Ministry of State Security. What's really interesting about this one, though, is like that they were rolling with really shitty like tradecraft and still being really successful. Like this indictment is an indictment of a different kind. It is a sad indictment of the state of information security, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the idea that, you know, a crew of two could just, you know, take on work from the government and go about their business and break into, you know, a bunch of pretty high profile things and, you know, do, you know, real international grade, you know, cybering, you know, on a pretty, you know, kind of cottage scale in a way, using off-the-shelf tooling, no particularly sophisticated bugs. There's some examples, I think, of them, you know, getting some zero-day off the Ministry of State Security to use in a particular case. But by and large, yeah, just using bog-standard, boring, you know, web shells and password guessing and password spraying and phishing and, you know, normal sorts of techniques. And really underscoring that, you know, the persistence is the important bit of APT, and the advanced just means, like, they've got a job to do, not technically advanced.
Yes.
But yeah, and of course they were also rolling, you know, like crime operations on the side, you know, side hustle, making a bit of cash here and there. And that's one of the aspects of this particular one that's kind of interesting, is the US government specifically calling out, you know, China for harboring, you know, cyber criminals that were also doing state-sponsored actual, you know, actual hacking. And that's a nuance that's kind of a bit different than just like straight up, you know, salarymen doing their job for the government. You know, it's a bit of a different thing when you've also got criminal activity mixed in.
Yeah, yeah. I got to say too, Brett Winiford did some excellent analysis in this week's Risky Business newsletter, and he did point out that back in April, the Australian Signals Directorate and NSA put out a guide about detecting web shells, and he Brett pointed out that we only gave it 34 words in the newsletter, but it turns out, you know, probably a lot of that activity was attributable to these guys.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're 10-year-old, 15-year-old web shells, so, like, they still work, right? They're absolutely a valid technique. But yeah, maybe, you know, spotting particularly China chopper in your environment is a thing that you'd hope that people would have the capability to do, you know, these days.
Finally. Yeah, and it's, look, I mean, it's turned into a real political storm, obviously. United States has evicted the Chinese from one of their consulates in Houston, and I think they closed down one of their own consulates in China, and it's, you know, it's just been, yeah, pretty crazy. And of course, you know, one of the things that these guys have been accused of going after is COVID-19 related research. Interestingly enough, Russia is also being accused of going after COVID-19 related research. But we know also Iran's doing it, and like everybody's doing it. We even wrote a feature about this a couple of months ago and we published it on risky.biz.
Yeah. I mean, these guys were hitting, you know, medical and pharmaceutical related things long before COVID was a thing. But yeah, the idea that they would be tasked absolutely makes sense. And yeah, the Russians and the Iranians and, you know, probably everybody else. I'm sure the Five Eyes are, you know, all up in the Chinese pharma industry as well, because yeah, everyone's playing this game.
Yeah. I mean, it's all about what's in the national interest, right? And, yeah, of course. You know, interesting research pertaining to a way to make the vid go away. I mean, that's good. Now, Yahoo actually broke another excellent national security story while I was on break. This report from July 15 was written by Zach Dorfman, Kim Zetter, and Jenna McLaughlin, as well as Sean D. Naylor. So that's quite a collection of bylines there. But some time ago, of course, we spoke about how the NSA and Cyber Command were given more autonomy in the way that they could conduct operations. It turns out they weren't alone. The CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, has also been given, maybe not carte blanche, but they've been certainly given more autonomy to go and give countries like Iran a hard time. I mean, it makes you feel a bit uneasy, doesn't it? When you're like, oh, a little bit less oversight for the CIA, because these aren't intelligence, you know, they're not just tasked with sort of intelligence collection and sort of attack disruption missions. You know, the CIA, its missions tend to be a little bit more political.
Well, yeah. I mean, the idea of letting the CIA off the chain a bit, you know, does have, given their history, you know, a bunch of concerns involved.
What could go wrong?
I know, right? I mean, and, you know, especially when you're starting to play in the kinetic space, right? And obviously there's been a few things going boom in Iran lately, and there's no direct attribution that this was CIA, but I mean, that's certainly one of the options. When you're starting to play that game, right, and obviously they did it Stuxnet time, like making things, you know, kinetically go boom and, you know, interfering with political stuff and doing the sorts of things that, you know, we've been pillorying Russia for, you know, stealing political data and leaking it during elections, like getting into all of those games does erode, you know, what limited moral high ground, you know, the US might be able to claim in foreign policy. And, it, you know, letting that decision-making happen further down the chain comes with risks. Now, I'm sure that there are a bunch of things where, you know, the CIA probably could have done useful things that have been held back by red tape. And there seems to be a lot of people, you know, who are quoted in some of these stories saying, hey, you know, it's about time we got a bit more freedom. It doesn't take years and years and years of building, you know, intelligence dossiers to tie, for example, you know, charities that are actually doing things, you know, for governments, you know, tying them together to make them a legit target. There's a lot of things that probably they would, you know, are quite happy about. But yeah, just given the history of the CIA, you know, makes you feel a little bit awks.
Yeah, apparently they've been given, you know, the authority to go around doxing APT crews, which is pretty funny. And we did see some Iranian APT crews getting doxed a little while ago, and it looks like that was probably the CIA.
Yeah, and of course there was the, you know, some FSB contractors that had a bunch of stuff done.
We spoke about that. Yeah, and we were like, gee, I wonder who this was. It was clearly someone aligned with Western intelligence, but, you know, to find out it was the CIA is pretty funny. It's like, yeah, welcome to the IRC wars of the 90s, CIA, right? Yeah, like, it's just crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's a wild ride to watch. And of course, you know, part of the challenge here, and especially reading the reporting, is so much of this just happens in the shadows by, you know, by design. That's what the CIA does. And so it's really hard to know what's going on. Like, are they actually blowing up ships in Iran and facilities in Iran? We don't know, right? Are they doxing the FSB? Probably. But yeah, we just don't know. And it's hard to read into, you know, what this means. This was a couple of years ago, right? So they've had, you know, some time to really ramp stuff up. You know, we saw some of their tool chain with the Vault 7 leaks. So you get a bit of an idea about what the capability was a bunch of years ago. And letting that off the leash, yeah, you can kind of extrapolate as to what they could do. But who knows, right? What's actually, you know, happening on the ground.
Yeah. I mean, it's all fun stuff. I love the quote from a former US official in this piece, which says, our government is basically turning into f***ing WikiLeaks.
Well, yeah, and that's, you know, that is somewhat more problematic. I mean, that sort of approach to things. I mean, the, you know, the more traditional things of the CIA, you know, arming people and regime change, at least we kind of understand that. But what does it mean when the CIA is WikiLeaks? I don't even know anymore.
You did say, though, that, you know, the USA's moral authority might be eroded by this. But, I mean, it's just when they're under constant attack using these tactics by Iran, you know, China, Russia, North Korea, like the idea of actually biting back against those countries in particular, I don't know if that's as high ground eroding as some people might, you know, gasp and shout about. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, for those, you know, those adversaries, right, it's kind of clear that this is probably proportional. But it's just, when is everybody else looking on, you know, and thinking about their own, you know, India versus Pakistan, or, you know, all the things that the French get up to, or, you know, all of the other, you know, other players that are, you know, looking for guidance as to what the norms are, you know, and considering what they mean in the context of their own conflicts, then, yeah, that's, I guess, you know, it's pretty clear when it's North Korea, or Iran or Russia.
I mean, look at this next story, right, which is that hackers from the GRU are apparently hitting US government and energy targets, for God's sakes.
Well, yeah, exactly, right. When they're up in your critical infrastructure, up in systems like that, then, yeah, you can absolutely see that it makes sense to go, you know, and at least be in a position to do, you know, the equivalent proportional thing back. And, yeah, it's, you know, when we're seeing crews that we know are effective, you know, in the style of Fancy Bear, you know, going after energy targets, then, yeah, that's got to be pretty concerning. And, you know, you can imagine that factoring into, you know, letting a few of the hounds loose.
Yeah, the NSA and CISA have warned about a, you know, looming uptick in attacks against OT and ICS as well, right? So there's something going on at the moment. We've seen a CVSS 10 in some Schneider Electric stuff, which is like, I don't know though, it always makes a good headline, doesn't it, when there's a CVSS 10 in some ICS gear. But fundamentally, when you're on an ICS network, it doesn't really matter if the devices are vulnerable because you're on the network, right?
Yeah, exactly right. Getting there is the real part of the journey. Once you're there, then you're probably not going to use an exploit versus a PLC or anything anyway. You're just going to go use the HMI, pointy-clicky your way through it like everybody else.
Yep. Now, of course, you mentioned that things have been going bang quite a lot in Iran. Apparently, someone has been attacking. There have been more attacks launched against Israel's water infrastructure. You know, people trying to overdose the water on chlorine and things like that. I mean, there's nothing to suggest that the things going bang in Iran are actually, you know, the result of action by some sort of hostile state hostile to them. There's nothing to suggest that. I mean, this is a country that's suffering under sanctions, so I imagine their critical infrastructure isn't in the best shape. But still, that said, yeah, a lot going on over there, and I would suggest that more attacks against Israel's water system will maybe result in a few more things going bang in Iran.
I mean, it certainly does feel like a bit of tit for tat there. And, you know, Israel going in, you know, with a sort of a multiple response, you know, when one thing happens in Israel, lots of things happen in Iran. Like, that's kind of the pattern that they want to establish. But, yeah, we don't know for sure that these things are all related. But it just, you know, there is very much an alignment of intent, you know, between, you know, all of the various things happening. So, yeah, if you look after water infrastructure in Israel, yeah, definitely change those passwords.
Now, another thing that happened when I was on break, which was actually kind of funny, was a bunch of blue ticks, high-profile blue ticks on Twitter getting owned and being used to, you know, send bitcoins to this address, and I'll send you double the amount back. Like, and it's crazily enough, people actually fell for it, right? Like, I think CoinDesk managed to block the address and, you know, stem the flow of money to it. But the attackers still made off with six figures. What's funny too is everyone's like, and this was the thing that I found quite funny when I was on break and not having to really engage with it, was like, there was the whole, oh, this is a really sophisticated attack brigade, but it turns out it was like kids, you know, it's just like kids having fun.
Yeah, no, it was certainly quite the drama on the day, but it's funny how quickly it's sort of faded back into insignificance now. But yeah, it was a pretty big deal seeing a whole bunch of Twitter accounts like that all simultaneously tweeting out really dumb, you know, like really dumb things. And of course, you know, there were people who were like, oh my God, this is sophisticated. It really is this dumb. Like, they are genuinely actually trying to scam Bitcoin out of people, you know, from high profile stuff. On high-profile Twitter accounts, like, which make no sense. Like, it just seems such a dumb way to try and monetize. It's so obviously going to get shut down quickly, and maybe it's a cover for something else. Maybe they're doing something really, you know, it's a diversion. So there was a lot of confusion as to what was going on. And of course, Twitter had
Sometimes these things are as dumb as they look, right?
Sometimes they really are that dumb.
And I mean, look, I want everybody to ask themselves a question, which is, why don't a lot of, okay, think of the intelligence professionals in cybersecurity, and I mean declared public facing people. Think of people like Mike Burgess, who runs ASIO here in Australia, used to run ASD. Think about people like Rob Joyce, you know, of NSA. Do they have blue ticks? No. And I wonder why that is. Maybe it's that they recognize that, you know, having an outlet purporting to be sort of official can cause problems when someone else takes over your account. It's almost like they've thought about this.
Almost like it, yeah. but I mean, Twitter's response was kind of fun to watch because, I mean, they had to, you know, do it whilst everyone was there on the platform talking about it, and they shut down blue ticks from being able to tweet at all. Which
that was pretty funny. Yeah, it was like the revolution, wasn't it? It was like, yeah, their heads are on sticks. Lots of jokes about how much better Twitter was without the blue ticks.
although there were some smart people who realized they could retweet, and then there's a Twitter account with like just tweets, were single word tweets.
Yeah,
and so people were making sentences by retweeting, which was pretty funny. But watching the instant response play out, you know, kind of in near real time as Twitter was trying to do, it was very interesting. There's lots of us who like that sort of, you know, Windows seat Statler and Waldorf instant response, and we're not responsible for it ourselves, but we get to watch. And they handled it pretty well, pretty quickly, it seemed. But yeah, the story, you know, is kind of gradually coming out, and it does look like it really was actually just forum kids who like stealing, you know, old, short usernames, you know, getting some internal accounts for the support systems, resetting the emails, doing password reset, taking over accounts. Like, it really did seem that dumb.
Yeah.
And also there was some talk about Twitter having, you know, an admin panel password pinned in Slack. I don't think that's been confirmed yet, but certainly sounds believable.
Yeah, it does. But I mean, so, you know, this is the thing that, you know, people get in a flap and they say, what if someone hacks Trump's Twitter account and says, I've just fired nuclear missiles towards North Korea? And like, yeah, but I mean these sort of incidents show us that, you know, it's probably not going to get believed. Well, hopefully not.
I mean, it's interesting that they didn't go after Trump. And like, you got to wonder what internal controls at Twitter made that not the case.
Oh, you would think that account would be radioactive, man.
If you've got any
sort of access to Twitter's back-end systems, which it looks like may have been the case here, then you would just stay well away from it.
I mean, you would hope, but then again, I mean, this did seem pretty dumb, right? I mean,
yeah.
So, I mean, I was kind of hoping that was going to happen a little bit, but, you know, oh well. We just got Kanye instead, so.
We got Kanye, we president. Got Joe Biden, we got Barack Obama, and Adrian Lamo. So, I mean, I would have DM'd with Adrian, so some of my messages are probably among those that got downloaded by the attackers, so you can see my...
Yeah, because that is one interesting point. They did use the data export function to export, you know, the contents of some people's account, a subset,
yeah.
Like 8 or something. So that's not great. And I would have, you know, when we were talking around the office and it was happening, it's like, this is just a diversion so they can exfil like the entire DM database, but it doesn't seem that that's happened.
Oh, come on. Like, it's just so funny when people come up with those scenarios. Like, I saw people tweeting, oh, we have to assume that all DMs are compromised. And it's like, well, you should be using them that way anyway.
Well, exactly. Yeah, you should.
But the idea that someone can come in and just exfil like a huge tranche of DMs and for that not to get shut down pretty quick. I mean, like, they have incident responders, guys. Come on.
I mean, they do, right, clearly. And the response felt relatively polished. So, I mean, that's...
It was, good. But it was pretty funny for a moment because it really did feel like the, you know, like a Lord of the Flies moment, didn't it? You
know, it did.
The forum kids have taken over. There really was that case where they were just like, just immediately when it was happening, people did not know what the hell was going on. You know, it was pretty crazy. Anyway,
yeah, it's fun to watch.
Oh, shit, like this thing is amazing. And again, I am... Color me shocked, Adam, absolutely shocked that this didn't result in the big one. You know how in California they're always waiting for that earthquake that's going to cause the country, you know, the state to break off from the rest of the country and float into the ocean? You know, there are some bugs that are kind of like that earthquake, but for the internet, and this is absolutely one of them. Talk us through this Windows DNS bug, because holy shit.
Yeah. Now, when you went away and everything started to melt down, as usual, like, this is the one that I thought was going to be the real meltdown, not some Twitter drama or whatever.
Yeah. So you agree with me that this is like the California quake bug?
I mean, this is a big deal bug. So some researchers from Checkpoint were rummaging around in the Windows DNS server, and they came up with a bug in query response parsing. So when the server is processing responses from other DNS servers that it's asked questions of on behalf of people who are, you know, asking it questions. When it parses a particularly crafted message, there is a integer overflow leading to heap memory corruption and potentially leading to code execution. And this bug, this kind of mishandling of the length of a packet inside the DNS message, goes back forever. Like, it's, you know, all versions of Microsoft DNS, you know, back to, you know, Win 2003 or something like that. So that's a big pool of things. Obviously, Windows DNS, you know, if you get that, you're domain admin. So that's a big deal. The researchers also suggested that they could at least trigger the bug via a web browser. So sending this message would require you to send a kind of crafted particular query to a DNS server and then have an attacker control the server that's responding to the intermediate Windows server. But they came up with a way to initially trigger this through a web browser by using the browser to post to port 53 TCP. So using the browser to send an HTTP message that gets interpreted by the DNS server as a DNS message, and then using that to at least trigger the bug. So you can do it from behind the firewalls, you know, without direct network reachability. And that's interesting.
Yes. They did a video on when I saw it. I mean, yeah, kind of mouth agape. It's like, whoa.
Yeah, I mean, it clearly had the potential to be a pretty big deal bug. Now, there's a bunch of exploit mitigation stuff, like control flow guards compiled in this particular case for the DNS server on Windows. You know, older Windows, obviously, you know, different story. And they also disclosed it in a way that didn't, you know, immediately give up all of the tricks for turning it into reliable code exec. But what a bug, a Windows DNS bug, and especially one that's, you know, kind of flexible enough that you can use in a real network, you know, without necessary direct reachability. Like, that's a big deal. And if you wormed it,
It
would be the biggest thing anyone ever seen.
Geez, a worm targeting domain controllers. I wonder if that would cause some problems.
Well, exactly right. I mean, that, you know, at least it appears to have been found. Actually, the Checkpoint guys, the Checkpoint people who did the research did go and rummage through some of the other parts of the DNS code base, so the DNS client, which appears to be like a slightly different code base, like it's not shared with the server, so it had slightly different parsing code. But anyway, there's some evidence that a similar bug perhaps was fixed in some other parts of the DNS processing in the past. So it's probably not the first time that someone's found this bug, but I think it's the first one that we've seen in public. So that's an interesting data point.
Yeah.
What a bug.
And we can't all have just one domain controller backing up all the other domain controllers that happens to be offline in an African country when the power goes out to restore everything from.
Oh, boy.
But I'm just really surprised. And look, hey, it's great that that didn't get wormed, because it would have been an absolute shit show if that had happened. But yeah, I mean, look, what a year for bugs, right? Because we've just seen bug after bug after bug. Apparently that F5 bug is getting exploited in the wild. We've also got a new Cisco bug, and that also comes from Mikhail at Positive Technologies. Like we said initially, like after he'd come up with like the second one of these, we're like, there's blood in the water and he can smell it, you know, and other sharks are going to come. But yeah, we're just seeing bug after bug after bug in network stuff. But that's all Mikhail at Positive Technologies. So, you know, well done to him. But is this one horrible as well?
The Cisco one gets you like arb read, and you can disclose some things like some session cookies and things. It's not like straight up code exec, but I'm pretty sure it would be a useful tool in your arsenal for being able to compromise those things. And it's also not 100% clear how many of Cisco's products it applied to, because it's the ASAs, but there's also they have the firepower range, which is a dumb name as well. It's a good Judas Priest album, bad name for a network product. So there may be some bits in there that, you know, it's not 100% clear from Cisco. Well, it's not 100% clear to me all the places that you can use it and what it means in all those contexts, because like fire reads like that are really useful for all sorts of stuff.
Yeah. And SAP bug as well, like apparently SAP, it's a pretty bad one. Also a big deal. Yeah, I mean, it's just, isn't it just great, the bugs we're seeing this year. It's like, it's proper like 90s style carnage and tempo.
Exactly. It warms my heart, right? This kind of pivot back towards bugs in real network applications.
Towards the permanent state of dread, right? Which is what it used to be like. So for people who are new to the industry, people who've come in the last 10 years, this is what it used to feel like.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it used to be, you know, bind bugs and RPC statd and bugs and all sorts of network listening services. And yeah, this does feel kind of old school in a way. And, you know, I kind of like it. These are the bugs that I grew up with, rather than, you know, web apps are complicated and hard and OAuth, like who even knows how that works anymore. So yeah, it's nice to have bugs that we understand, you know, DNS, heap overflow, you know, integer overflow. I get that. That's good.
Yeah, yeah, you need to have, like, when you read the advisory, it needs to come with some, like, text art in it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I want to ask you out of my advisories.
Yeah. Exactly. I didn't say ASCII art because it's not generally as colourful as the BBS ASCII art of the 90s.
We like some ANSI art. That's what we want.
ANSI art. There we go. Thank you, Adam. Oh, my God. I actually out-pedanted you on something technical. That's a hell of an achievement. I'm giving myself a gold star for that.
Well, actually, it's UTF-8 art now.
God damn it. No. I lost the crown already. We've spoken about this, you know, QNAP NAS malware going around, which, you know, we sort of mentioned it reluctantly a couple of times on the show. But it turns out out. Caesar reckons it's gone out and hosed like 62,000 QNAP NAS devices, which is a pretty decent botnet. I mean, you could DDoS some stuff with that if you were smart about Reflection. And I mean, you could ransomware them. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff you could do.
And actually, it sounds like the particular malware that's doing this is actually pretty full-featured, you know, exfilling the data off the NASs and remote access backdoors and, you know, credential logging. And so, yeah, I mean, someone's making a good go of
exfilling the data. I mean, who's got that much storage? What sort of attacker has got enough storage to swallow 62,000 NASs?
Well, I guess you have to have a second NAS botnet to back up your first NAS botnet too. I don't know.
Can you imagine their Amazon bill if they were going to do it that way? Yeah, their S3 bill. Yikes.
Yeah.
But, you know, do we know anything about who's doing this or why? And why does Caesar care?
Well, that's a good question. We don't know who's behind it, you know, and as to why Caesar cares. I mean, they must have hit something interesting. You know, someone must have been backing up their, you know, defense stuff on a NAS to get their attention.
Well, I mean, they do say there is a line in this story, which is by Catalin Kimpanu, which says, Caesar and NCSC urge companies to patch QNAP NAS devices, which is like, hang on, did you say companies? What?
Mm-hmm, yeah. So I imagine there must be some defense contracts that are storing juicy stuff on their QNAPs. So yeah, that's a terrible idea. Don't do that.
Yeah, it's probably true though, right? Like that's...
I mean, it's almost certainly true. Like, I mean, everything is true. It's just that bad.
Garmin got themselves ransomware pretty good with Wasted Locker, according to reports. Apparently, everything's back now. I actually had kind of a bit of a snitch feeding me info on this one as it was happening, which was pretty cool. And it looks like, yeah, they started passing around the decryptor yesterday. No idea on whether or not they paid. And if they did pay, that might present them with some problems, given that Evil Corp, which are the developers of the malware, are actually under sanctions, right? So you can get in a lot of trouble for sending these people money. Even if you used a third party, which there's some talk that maybe Garmin used a third party. But of course, you know, Garmin doesn't just make consumer devices. They make all sorts of interesting technology, interesting GPS technology. But what do we know about this story, Adam?
So it appears they got ransomware. I mean, sounds like, you know, regular sort of email delivery. There was some evidence that there were some samples uploaded to VirusTotal from Taiwan, from Garmin's, you know, Garmin-related payloads from Taiwan. So maybe it started in some of Garmin's facilities there. The fact that they managed to respond to this so quickly, because we saw outages for their consumer devices, we saw, like, you know, aircraft flight systems that use Garmin navigation data not being able to update themselves. I don't think there's any reports of planes actually not flying as a result, but, you know, that's pretty sensitive stuff.
They can go back to paper maps when that stuff happens, according to my pilot friends. So
yeah, but I mean, you know, that's
not that, there's a booming aviation sector right now anyway, Adam.
But the fact that they managed to then turn that round into a back to being functional in so few days does lend credence to some of the reports that maybe they managed to obtain a decryptor somehow. And they did, I think some sources were saying specifically they didn't pay, but, well, I think it said like they didn't directly pay, which is where I guess people have been saying like maybe they paid indirectly or something like that, you know, through a third party. And yeah, we don't know exactly how bad it went, but I mean, it seemed to affect them globally, and it does not, you know, that sounds pretty bad.
But yeah, look, I mean, we just have to see if they did pay either directly or through a third party. We're going to have to see if prosecutors or authorities in the United States are actually going to go after them for it, because I don't know that it's entirely clear whether or not violating sanctions when you're under duress is like still the same as like doing it to support the sanctioned entity. I don't know. But this is kind of uncharted territory, so it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I suspect we just won't hear anything about it. You know, that's, if I had to guess, that's how it's going to go.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it's really in anyone's interests to make a big scene out of that yet. I mean, I think it will come eventually to a head, but yeah, we're just not going to know, I guess, until...
Until it does, yeah.
Until it does.
Good news, everyone. Well, North Korea is apparently really stepping up its ransomware game, according to some research from Kaspersky, which has been written up by Shannon Vavra at CyberScoop.
Yeah, we've obviously seen North Korea use, you know, hacking to get money, you know, mostly through SWIFT stuff, SWIFT hacking to, you know, fund their economy. You know, branching out into more common, you know, common garden ransomware operations does make sense for them. And Kaspersky's reporting on the Lazarus Group being tied to some kind of, you know, more traditional ransomware style payloads being dropped around the place. And yeah, you can totally see them. They've got quotas to make. I'm sure they have, you know, a chart on their, you know, on the whiteboard in their office in, you know, North Korea that tells them exactly how much money they have to make this month for the great leader, the dear leader. And yeah, I mean, doing it via ransomware seems to be working for everybody else, so they want to get in on the game.
Who knew communism came with such heavy KPIs, right?
Ain't that right? Oh, dear.
Anyway, I guess, though, you know, factory output targets, all that sort of stuff, they are a metrics-driven bunch, so I guess it makes
sense. I guess they do own the means of production, right? They got the ransomware right there. So.
That's right. What do we got? Oh, yeah, so this is funny. Emotet disappeared for a while. I think it was like 5 months. And then they came back and, you know, basically it's a self-sourcing pudding, right? So it's malware that sends itself onwards to other targets and whatnot and just tries to go far and wide. But someone out there is kind of trolling them by so what they're doing is they're hosting payloads on compromised WordPress blogs and places like that. And someone's going in and replacing the payloads with GIFs, right? So Sharon DeGrippo, who is a friend of the show, she works at Proofpoint. I asked her about this to tell us a bit about what's going on, and here's what she had to say.
The hero we need, has gone out and found where the payloads are being downloaded for Emotet and has actually replaced those with some pretty funny memes. One of them was a GIF of James Franco. Another one was the WTF guy from the Blink-182 video. These are all hot linked to Giphy though so far. And so what that means is that Facebook, who owns Giphy, is actually siphoning up all of that delicious Emotet telemetry. I would love to know if Facebook is making that available back to the community, because now essentially what they have is a massive cache of Emotet intel and Emotet IOCs that we would love to have back from them if they'd like to participate in some of the intel sharing groups. So Emotet is back. I don't normally do predictions because I'm usually wrong, but I predict that Emotet will probably send every weekday for the next 4 to 6 weeks at least. We might see it continue on through the summer. They lost a lot of money in terms of opportunity cost being shut down from early February to mid-July. So I imagine they'll try to be making up that cost, and we'll see what they do.
I do find it interesting, actually, that by doing it, and as far as I know, it's like a straight HTTP 200 redirect from the payload sites. You know, redirecting them off to one company, actually, I mean, you know, it would be good. I doubt Facebook's going to share this telemetry, right? But apparently that's not really how they roll. But it would be good if they did, because they would have collected heaps of info on infected hosts, right?
Yeah, I'm sure that would be quite a useful data set for them to have a look at and share about, perhaps. But yeah, it's always funny seeing this kind of, you know, you might want to say black hat on black hat, but I mean, it's probably just some security researcher who's a little bored.
Isn't it almost perverse that doing that is illegal? You know what I mean? Like actually swapping out a malware payload for a GIF of James Franco by popping an already popped WordPress blog. Technically, that's a computer crime. That's ridiculous. Well, we need law reform now.
I mean, yeah, clearly it's a crime. And you've got to hope that whoever's doing this OPSEC is pretty tight.
Come on, man. That's like 10 minutes in tour. Like, it's really not hard.
I mean, I know, but, you know, if you're going to go mess with crime groups, like, you do want to make sure, because they're not going to be happy about being made fun of, you know, with dank memes when they're just trying to deliver ransomware.
I think that's what makes this so funny, though, is it's not just like trying to replace it with a payload that uninstalls their dropper or whatever. Like, they're straight up just mocking them with GIFs.
Oh dear. Yeah.
They want to be useful, but not too useful, you know?
Yeah.
Not to the detriment of actually getting a laugh.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, we salute whoever the hero of the internet of the day is. Good job with the gifts.
And we would like to buy him or her or they a beer.
Exactly.
Yeah. What else have we got? Oh, so this is something that we covered pretty early on, actually. It was a TrustWave report that Brett spotted and wrote up for the newsletter weeks ago. This was the instance where if you were using the state-mandated Chinese tax software, like their VAT calculation software, turns out it was dropping malware onto computers. Just, you know, hey, totally not connected to the government or anything, even though it's a state-owned operation, the software company. But yeah, it turns out, Adam, this Golden Helper and Golden Spy malware stuff is a little more prevalent than when we first realized.
Yeah, no, there's been reports of this stuff going back a number of years now. And actually, there's also some interesting correlations between the two bits of malware, you know, in terms of like similar signing keys and stuff as well.
Now, hang on, just clear it up for us. Why are there two bits of malware? Why are there two? Why is there not one?
So there's two sets of companies that provide this software in China, and they are, you know, ostensibly separate companies.
Oh, and they're both dropping malware on people.
And they're both dropping malware on people.
That's a coincidence, isn't it? I mean, that's wild.
And then some of them are signed, some of the components are signed by the same certificate that's owned by one of these two otherwise independent companies. Which
that's
is a
amazing
curious
that,
as well.
that totally not government-related malware crew happened to breach their signing infrastructure. I mean, that's just crazy.
I know. What a shock, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, the idea that software that you have to use when you're inside China you know, is backdoored, obviously, is not a surprise. We have seen some of the stuff now shut down when the detection rates started really spiking after some of these reports. But we've now also seen the FBI put out a flash alert, you know, warning companies about this particular thing and talking about a couple of other examples, like other than the TrustWave customers, of people that have been running this stuff when they've been operating in China and, you know, presumably getting themselves good and owned. You know, it's hard to say that, you know, if we take away the malware version of doing this, that we don't end up with just a mandated, you must install, you know, this particular government backdoor new system rather than a surreptitious one. You know, maybe that's where we end up with this particular arms race. But yeah, certainly a solid reminder for everybody doing business in China that, you know, when you get that, you know, pre-installed Win7 home box show up that you have to plug in the accountancy department, then, you know, treat it with care.
Well, I mean, you treat it like uranium, basically, and firewall it off from basically everything else. I would think that's the only sensible thing to do here. Any state-mandated software, if you're a multinational company and there is one box through which you have to provide, you know, your quarterly or monthly updates to the tax office or whatever, you just seal it off from the rest of the network.
Yeah, I mean, I would lay in a separate circuit, like get a DSL line or something like that and, like, put it on its own.
Get a
goddamn
SIM card and 4G it. It's not exactly bandwidth
exactly,
intensive.
Right. Something like that, yes. Yeah. Keep it the hell away from everything else.
Yeah, I think that is a good move. That is a good move. We've got the Iranian OPSEC story of the week, Adam. APT-35 apparently leaked a whole bunch of their training videos. It's been a while since we've used the sad trombone button, but there it is. Tell us about this.
Yeah, no, IBM X-Force, I guess, compromised the C2 box or found, you know, some open file shares or something, or open web servers on a C2 box, where they had uploaded, the Iranian operators had uploaded some, you know, like tens of gigabytes of training videos where they were walking through, you know, how to do, you know, Gmail account compromise, how to exfil the data, how to test all the credentials. And it's just a really interesting insight into, you know, how these operators work. Obviously, you have to train people on the job. It's a great way to learn. And yeah, having these videos, you know, lying around, obviously not great. Now, IBM X-Force haven't actually shared the videos because some of them are live. Well, yeah, exactly, right? Some of them do contain live hacking of, like, at least one US military service person. I think there's also a Greek military person who has their, like, Yahoo Mail rummaged through as a demo. But, yeah, there's a few other bits of, you know, interesting tradecraft in there. Like, for example, one of the tricks they use for monitoring email accounts that they've compromised is to hook it up to an open-source Zimbra mail server, you know, set up IMAP account access, and just hook their Zimbra up to your, you know, cloud email service, and then they can just, you know, use pointy-clicky webmail to access your webmail through an IMAP interface. So, yeah, that's an interesting way of doing it, I suppose.
If it works, but yeah, right? Like, I mean, that does actually make a lot of sense as well, because they don't have to worry about debolding the wrong thing in your inbox.
Yeah, exactly right. And also, I mean, SIGINT agencies are very good at ingesting email. And I imagine that applies to, you know, non-NSA SIGINT agencies as well, you know. And so getting an email feed that you can feed into your existing framework and have all the analysts do their thing, yeah, that all kind of makes a lot of sense. But yeah, the sad thing is we haven't actually seen the raw videos. There's a few screenshots that have been shared in the media and on the X-Force blog post about this. But yeah, we haven't seen the actual videos. So it's hard to say what else of value is in there. But either way, it's pretty funny.
Now, Adam, moving on. We're gonna go from the write-up written by Lily Hay Newman at Wired, but plenty of outlets have this story. After a year, Apple has indeed finally launched its security research device program, which looks, you know, pretty much, it looks like they're going to deliver on what's advertised. You get a researcher-friendly iPhone, which is a lot easier to hack. You basically get console, you know, you get shell access into the thing, and you know, a bunch of it is more visible to you than it would be in a normal sort of locked consumer iPhone. But, you know, it comes with all of the catches that we'd expect, which is you have to agree to Apple's terms. They pick who they give them to. You don't actually own the phone. It's on like a 12-month lease. You're not allowed to take the phone out of your house, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Oh, and when you report a bug to them, they get to choose when you get to talk about it, which has already led, you know, the Project Zero people to say, well, we're not going to participate if that's the case.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, pretty much what we expected it to look like. And I don't, you know, there's obviously there's some people for whom it's going to be disappointing and for whom, you know, the terms of that deal are not worth it. And I mean, Project Zero, certainly I can see them, you know, their disclosure standard obviously is incompatible with that. And that's fair
but
enough.
But it's also the fact that they, I really doubt Project Zero needs this. You know what I mean? Well, like, exactly. So it's very easy for them to say, oh, you know, we shan't agree to these terms when really they just do not need it whatsoever.
Yeah, exactly. They're an example of an organization that doesn't really need it, right? And, you know, there's also been a lot of people saying, oh, well, it doesn't give you access to the bootloader. It doesn't really give you, you know, kernel, the ability to look for kernel bugs particularly well. And that's also true, right? There's no suggestion that's going to put, you know, people who are, you know, in the market for finding those sorts of bugs at a better place, right? They're going to be exactly where they were before. Where this is going to work well is for people who are focusing on application level stuff and app sandboxing and bits like that. And there's a lot of good work to be done in that region. And for those reasons, researchers, this makes a lot of sense.
A few WebKit bugs coming at you, you know?
Yeah, yeah, well, exactly. There's been a fair amount of those, right? And I can still see that there is a lot of people for whom this will be a useful thing to have and for whom the terms will be acceptable, and there's other people who won't. And that's, you know, that's all totally fine, and it's absolutely better than, you know, where Apple was 2 years ago, where you didn't have this option and you just had to go jailbreak or, you know, Corellium or, you know, or what, you know, what other options you've got, which are not very many, right? Jailbreak or Corellium or, you know, buy a dev fused phone from China or something. So yeah, it's good to have better options. And yeah, obviously, as with any Apple thing, you take it the Apple way or you don't take it at all.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And, you know, no updates to be had on the Corellium lawsuit just yet, but, you know, the thing is still alive. It's by no means over. So we'll bring you updates on that when we know more. Now this one is actually pretty interesting. Back in 2019, Brian Krebs wrote a story about how First American Financial Corp had exposed 885 million records. And these records were relating to mortgages, right? So contained a lot of sensitive PII, et cetera, et cetera. Looks like this company is now going to be charged over the exposure. This wasn't a breach. They just left this stuff lying around. But I mean, compounding their culpability here is that they were warned about this in a pen test report and didn't do anything about it for something like 6 months until Brian's report actually forced them to address it. But, you know, this does look like they absolutely weren't taking appropriate steps to secure PII, and they're going to get whacked with a big stick for it.
Yeah, it certainly does look like they're going to get a bit of a whacking. I mean, some of the fines look like they could be up to, what, like $1,000 per record breached.
Yeah.
And, you know, that will depend on whether or not they mean exposed or whether they mean actually taken, or, you know, where that kind of that ground lies for kind of how bad it could be for them. But the fact that they got told about it and didn't fix it, that's clearly not going to look good. And, you know, the sensitivity of the data, obviously also a big deal. One of the things they'd been using to defend themselves was, well, we didn't actually see very many records get taken. And when Krebs asked them how far back their logs went, they hummed and hawed and said they had logs which covered a period that were typical for a company of its size and nature.
That is wonderful. That is glorious PRing right there. That is absolutely spectacular. But look, it's the New York State Department of Financial Services that's going after them for this.
Yeah, and I suspect very big stick going to get very whacked over their knuckles. And frankly, it looks like they deserve it.
Yeah. This next one comes to us from Lorenzo over at Vice Motherboard. They've got a hold of some audio that was left as a voicemail message for someone, like pretending to be a CEO, like instructing an employee to do something shady. It looks like, you know, your typical sort of scam type behavior, but they're calling this deep fake audio, which really they've embedded the audio. It does actually sound like text to speech. And they've also linked through to a report from a company called Nissos. And I can tell you straight up, as someone who spends like hours every week and has done for like over a decade in front of spectral displays, their reasoning about why this looks like a deep fake, you know, based on spectral analysis is complete bullshit. All you have to do is actually listen to the audio and go, yeah, that's text to speech. You know, forget about spectral displays and whatnot. They're not going to tell you it's silly. But nonetheless, this is the second report we've seen that looks at synthetic speech being used to sort of impersonate other people and, you know, for that to be used by fraud. Although this is a terrible example of it, you've got to expect that sometime soon, the tech is going to get to the position where it's effective. And in fact, one of your colleagues has done some work in synthesizing your voice and my voice and sending us samples and freaking us out, right? So it's getting there.
Yeah, I mean, the technology is absolutely at a point where you could use it, especially over a phone or in voicemail where, you know, the audio fidelity is so low and people are used to things sounding crappy. But yeah, the tech is absolutely up for this kind of impersonation. This particular report is not at all compelling, and you know, they didn't manage to succeed in scamming the employee that they were leaving voice messages for. But yeah, the tech is good. And when you hear it, I mean, my colleague that's been synthesizing us from the podcast recordings, it's pretty freaky, actually.
It is when they've got you singing "How much is that doggy in the window," etc.
Yeah,
et cetera.
Exactly.
Or the one with the waggly tail.
We're extolling the virtues of Bitcoin. He synthesized me, offering important details on Bitcoin, how to invest. It's pretty scary and pretty easy to do once when you're familiar with the tools and the frameworks for doing so. Like, it's not a lot of training work. Like, I think it was less than an hour of GPU time to train the models for you and I off samples of the podcast. Like, it really wasn't a lot of work. And then from there, you can just kind of sock puppet whatever you like, and it's definitely better than this particular effort.
Well, it's funny, right? Because when deepfakes popped up as a thing, it's like, oh no, it's going to be compromat, fake compromat about leaders. And no, it's going to be voicemails asking for Bitcoin and for invoices to be paid to shady accounts. Like, that's where this stuff is going, right, to begin with. What else have we got? We've got that DNA website, GEDmatch or GEDmatch. They've called it a data breach. Basically, they screwed up and reverted permissions on accounts belonging to police, allowing them to search accounts that hadn't opted in to police searches or something like that. I don't know. It's not really a massive story. We got another one from Joe Cox at Motherboard talking about how police are actually getting access through threat intelligence style firms, wind up actually getting access to stolen data, and that there might be some ethical problems there. That's a decent little write-up. And in fact, he's got another story talking about how Senator Ron Wyden plans to introduce legislation in the United States that would prohibit police from buying access to information that would otherwise only be available to them by warrant.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense to have that conversation because, I mean, when the data has already been stolen, is lying around, or, you know, in the case of, you know, cell site location data, which is one of the examples of what Ron Wyden was trying to get police to not buy on the open market, you know, when that data is available, you can kind of see, you know, why obtaining it would make sense, you know, when the police are trying to solve a particular problem. But yeah, it's a particularly interesting kind of gnarly problem when you're dealing with stolen data and when, you know, your participation in that marketplace encourages it to exist, right? I mean, you're supporting the criminals that are doing the theft of the data, and some of these services are, you know, some of them are, you know, clearly very, you know, this is the same people doing the crime, they're just monetizing the data in another way as well as selling it on the underground, whereas others are a little bit more white hat about it, and it's hard to tell from the outside which is which, of course. It's a thicket of you know, concerns and kind of issues and what makes sense, because I mean, you want law enforcement to be able to, you know, get the breached contents of a child exploitation forum, for example, and be able to act on it. But, you know, you don't want them hanging around the forums trading for that data. So, yeah, it's a complicated set of issues.
Well, and you don't want them going onto, you know, you don't want them buying weird stuff from marketing firms either. I think that's more what this one is aimed at. But you're quite right that you need to do this carefully. Otherwise, you're going to be covering up some, you know, some of this stuff is good, I think, is what we're both trying to say. There we go. For Captain Eloquent here, some of it is good.
Great analysis. Top work.
Top work analysis. I'm not rusty at all after a couple of weeks off. We've got a story here from Krebs on Security about a data indexer called Data Viper getting owned. The main reason we're speaking about this is whoever did the deed actually gave us a shout out. It was like a zine style shout out. It's kind of funny.
Yeah. And this, you know, it's a good example of a shady operator that has a bunch of breach data that's then selling it. Like, it's exactly the sort of business, you know, that maybe you don't want the police interacting with. But yeah, this guy has been seen selling stuff on forums, you know, selling stolen data or publicizing data that, you know, where the companies in question don't know that they've been breached. So kind of on the shadier end of the business, and clearly has some enemies. And yeah, the zine describing someone breaking into a bunch of their boxes and RMing their data and stealing it and stuff is pretty old school, both in style, you know, ASCII art again. And yeah, us getting you specifically getting a shout out.
It was Risky Biz.
Well, I mean, maybe they mean Risky Biz like your Twitter handle. Maybe
no, because they used a Z. It's the website, man. It's you and me.
All right. We got some shout outs in the zine, which, you know, it's been a while since I got a zine shout. So
yeah.
Thanks, I guess.
So shout outs back to you, RMRF Shark. You know, weird old world, isn't it? Anyway.
It is.
Moving on. Oh, yeah. Okay, so we'll just touch on this briefly. Someone, by the looks of things, someone bought a Diebold ATM off eBay, put it in a little box, and now they go around, you know, connecting that to the cash hoppers on actual ATMs. You know, they get into the front fascia, hook up their Diebold ATM computer in a suitcase to the thing and get it to spit out all of its cash, which is kind of funny. And now Diebold are staging an investigation in how someone managed to get their proprietary tools. And it's like, it's so clear that it was like, dollars to donuts. Someone just bought one on eBay, like Barnes.
Exactly, right? Exactly. And how hard is it to pull off the, you know, the USB serial driver and understand what the wire protocol is to the cash dispenser and hook it up to empty itself, right? I mean, that's got to be a day's worth of work. And I'm sure it's not that hard. You know, if you have one to test with, I bet you could jackpot that pretty quick.
Sounds like you might be speaking from experience there, Adam.
Well, I mean, you know.
And finally, Adam, and just very, very quickly, Sony has coughed up $10,000 in its bug bounty for a PS4 kernel exploit. And I remember when they announced their bug bounty program, I said, my exact words were, there is gold in them there hills. And I'm telling you, there is more than one, there's more than one kernel exploit in the PS4. So get cracking, everyone, because I think after they pay out their first $2 million, they're probably going to tighten the criteria somewhat, so you might want to get on top of it.
Time to cash in on those old bugs.
That's right. But, mate, thank you so much. It's good to be back. It's good to be back after a little bit of time off, and can't wait to do it again next week, man. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Before we get to this week's sponsor interview, I have a hiring announcement. Internet NZ, the organisation that runs the .nz domain and NetHui conference and events, is hiring a security operations lead in Wellington. Internet NZ is a New Zealand non-profit dedicated to an internet for good. This new role is a part of a small team in a diverse and important organisation. Primarily, they're looking to build better monitoring and governance for their information security practice, but the role will include personnel and physical security as well, so I guess brush up on your kung fu. If you're looking to help protect the organisation that's making a difference to the future, then check out the link in this week's show notes and go ahead and apply. And obviously right now they are only taking applications from people who are physically located in New Zealand. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now. Brian Dye is the Chief Product Officer for Corelight. They make a network sensor based on the open source project Zeek, which was formerly known by its less woke name, Bro. And that's not a dig, by the way. I fully support the name change because, let's face it, a gendered network sensor does seem a little bit weird in retrospect. But anyway, what makes Corelight pretty unique is they just offer the network sensor part. They don't do analytics. They're not a SIEM provider. They don't offer the pane of glass. They do one thing and they do it well. They're that sort of company. And naturally, the types of companies that need massive scale network detection and response tend to be pretty big organizations with pretty big networks. Anyway, as regular listeners would know, we feel like network security gear has staged a bit of a comeback in recent years. And I started off by asking Brian if the InfoSec discipline basically kind of forgot about network security for a few years. And here's what he had to say.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say we forgot about it. We got enamored by the new shiny thing, right? And that's normal for security because we're always looking to stay on the cutting edge. But I don't think you have to look much farther than just the June episodes of your show to kind of see really clear evidence for why that isn't really a viable strategy, right? You look at the Ripple 20 vulnerability, right? Full 10 rating, super pervasive. Many organizations don't even know where they have that vulnerability, much less because it's all in embedded devices, not a good ability to go patch it. Same thing with CallStranger, right? Big universal plug and play vulnerability, everything from printers, projectors to TVs. You've got whole classes of devices that just aren't going to be suitable for endpoint instrumentation, even pretending if you could instrument actually all of your endpoints and have control over those. And it's that balance of kind of being using the endpoint depth for where you can, but then also using the network for what it's good for, right? You can't fake the network, right? So you don't have to worry about data credibility. You can't instrument most of those endpoints as we talked about. And the big one that I hear organizations talking about is the recognition that the endpoint, especially this NDR category, is an invisible defense, right? If you land on an endpoint, you can inventory it, you can see what defensive mechanisms are there, and then you can kind of mount whatever countermeasures you're going for. You don't know whether the network's monitored or not because it's all based off of passive taps. And that, I think, is one piece of the game theory that a lot of folks don't consciously recognize until they've really gone into the category.
Attackers can't know it's there. It's funny, right? Because you were just talking about those like Ripple 20 bugs and whatever. And yeah, in the all singing, all dancing, full end-to-end zero trust world, I mean, having someone on an IoT thing in your network is you know, not such a big deal. But that depends on you having 100% transitioned, which is never the case, right? And that depends on, say, you know, a device in your network never going out to a non-SSL website ever. Because, you know, if you've got the edge device, you can get in the middle there, you can do all sorts of stuff. So yeah, you kind of do need to keep an eye on the network, even if the ultimate goal is to never have to do that. You still have to.
Yeah. Unless you're 100% zero trust, in which case you're Google.
Yeah, basically,
for the rest of us, we've got to go and actually solve the problem.
And I'm pretty sure they would still be keeping an eye on the network, you know, like inside the buildings. I suspect that.
Without conveying anything confidential, yes, I have a high confidence they're still keeping an eye on the network.
Hey, now look, you know, while I got you here, one thing that I find really interesting, and, you know, we spoke about this just before we started recording as well, is one of the things that I get asked about a lot when CoreLite appears in a sponsored segment is like, you know, this is a network detection company or a network data company that doesn't do any analysis, right? So how is that a sustainable business model for them? You know, people are looking for more turnkey solutions. What would you say in response to that? Is your plan eventually to go more into being a you know, full service top to bottom vendor? Or, as you mentioned to me before we started recording, you know, you're signing some gargantuan deals with massive companies that just want network sensors, your customized Zeek network sensors. But what's the roadmap? What's the plan here, Brian?
Yeah, it's there's really three parts of it. I mean, first, there's a lot that you can do at the network edge, right? So what we see big, sophisticated open source shops doing, and frankly, we're learning from them and kind of really creating an integrated system based off of what these high-end organizations are doing. We see them pretty consistently deploying, you know, Zeek for the metadata and behavioral detection, kind of Suricata as an inline signature IDS, and then often supplementing that with some type of kind of selective or targeted PCAP. And so kind of bringing that integrated sensor to the edge as a high-performing, scalable, cost-effective system, there's actually a lot of people that want to take advantage of that right now because they've already got a SIM with some great analytics tools that they can feed that data into. And a lot of the folks that we're working with are pretty sophisticated defenders. They, you know, they're Fortune 100 companies, Fortune 500 companies, sometimes nation states. They've got big security engineering teams and pretty sophisticated ability to consume that. So the making that sensor edge as strong as we can, and frankly, making sure that the raw data is as powerful as it can be, is actually where we're starting. Because you've got all sorts of options for downstream analytics. You don't have all sorts of options to get better data later. If you don't get the right data at the start, you're up a creek, right? So you've got to get it right out of the gate. You know, the second piece that's really important for us is we're, you know, I hate to say it, we're not that smart, right? We're learning from great open source centric kind of enterprises that have their own sophisticated engineering teams, right? The web scale companies, the tech companies, the big three letter kind of intel agencies. We're learning from by watching what they're doing, and then we want to bring that innovation to everybody else, right? So learn from the folks that are really doing it that have huge engineering teams and a very, very low tolerance for risk. That's the second piece. And then the third one is we want to actually take advantage of what we really see as a very active participation of open source technologies in the NDR market. And I think this is really different from when the EDR market came around, where EDR market was pretty much all proprietary from the get-go. But in today's day and age, it's very different, right? You've got big threat sharing repositories, you know, like the Sigma rule base that's growing up pretty aggressively, right? We just added support for Zeekin to that, which is really powerful. I think MITRE ATT&CK really kicked all this off beforehand. There's actually a great Medium post by John Lambert from the Microsoft threat research team called The GitHubification of InfoSec that talks about how there's real benefit from all of us in having these collective pools of analytics tools that everybody can use, right? Rather than relying on a world, which is historically what we've been in, where everything is vendor proprietary. And that's something where I think we have the ability, because of our open source heritage, we have the mindset and the ability to really participate in that.
It's funny that you mentioned that though, because the last time network related security kit was all the rage, open source played a big part then as well in the form of Snort, right? Like, and Snort rules. It just seems like for some reason, the open source thing works better around network-centric stuff.
Yeah, I think it does. And I think there's something fundamentally different between what's happening now and what happened, you know, 10-ish years ago with Snort and everything else, which is that the half-life of the detections, right? The half-life of the behavioral insights is so much longer than the half-life of the signature. Right. If you can, you know, take the work that the Salesforce.com engineering team did around JA3, right, which I think most folks know about by now. Right. If you can find an attacker toolkit, if you can find Metasploit in your network, that's a really durable detection that forces the attacker to go and do something fundamentally differently. That's got a lot more value and a lot longer half-life. So than a given signature. So
oh, no, 100%, right? Like using IDS signatures from 20 years ago, probably not going to get you much these days, right? Like, not the way to do it. Doesn't scale. Doesn't quite work.
Not a ton of leverage there, right? So, yeah. But that makes the open source model a lot more viable, because if you're trying to crank through generating hundreds to thousands of signatures a day, you kind of have to turn that into an R&D function, right? You've got to go staff it and put headcount against it and everything else. If you can come up with a much smaller number of things with a much longer half-life, you can take advantage of that distributed innovation by people that have access to real network traffic and are looking at what attackers are doing, because you're really finding behaviors, you're not finding malware. And I think that's what's fundamentally different.
So this is interesting, right? Because I, you know, until we spoke earlier today, I didn't realize that basically CoreLite at this point, right, you're generating an awful lot of revenue from extremely large organizations. One question I do have though, and this is another one that's come up in conversations I've had, is people asking me, well, you know, aren't they worried that a company like Amazon are going to come along and essentially do the same thing with Zeek, which is an open source tool, right, that you have commercialized? Because really companies like Amazon, companies like Microsoft these days, companies like Google, essentially, their business model is about the commercialization of open source, right? They might offer it as a service, but fundamentally, their business is making money out of open source. Does it concern you that they might come along and start competing with you? And what would that look like?
It's definitely something we think about, but honestly, it's not something I'm super concerned about on two fronts. First, if you look at all the different companies you named, they've taken a very different approach towards open source, right? Amazon has gotten a lot of flack, right, for going in and kind of raiding open source projects. And I think both Microsoft and Google have recognized that and have taken a very different approach, right? They've actually been very open source friendly and have not taken the same strategy Amazon did. So kind of that, just on how those giants compete with each other is a different situation. And then the second piece is, if you look at the network practices for the cloud players, you don't have to look very much farther than the taps themselves. And the quality and availability of the network traffic in those different clouds is radically different. Google, I think, did a really good job with their tap functionality that came out the end of last year. They instrumented it well. It's pretty reliable. I've definitely talked to organizations that have used it. Microsoft has struggled. They were actually the first ones out, but then their tap actually hit a bug.
Is it gone?
They hit bug. They had to pull it.
Oh my God, I did not know this. I did not know that. That's interesting. So what was the bug? It must have been a doozy if they yanked it.
I wouldn't share something, Microsoft internal, certainly. I'd defer that to them. But I think they do care about the space, right? So they want to get this right. But it is taking them some time to get it right.
And when's that coming back? Because it had a name and everything, wasn't it? Like VTAP or something, or that might have been the Google one. But yeah, when's it coming back?
It's got a website. It's got everything. It's got everything except a return date. So we actually don't have
it. Dude, that's harsh.
Yeah. But the good news is I talked to lots of defenders that want it. I know the Microsoft team wants to get it done. So I think it's a matter of when, not if. But then if you look at the Amazon one, that's actually the one that's had the most technical issues with it, right? You know, one of the trickier parts is that they don't actually support the full standard package sizes because they they're essentially doing a NIC mirror. They do VXLAN encapsulation. That means they can't capture the full size packet. And their guidance to everybody was, well, you should just, you know, shrink the size, your max packet size in your network to whichever.
There's no efficiency problem there at all, right?
No, not so much. So if I think of the cloud players, they're at the point where they're trying to enable this discipline in the clouds, which they know defenders need.
So they've got to worry about getting your stuff to work before they try to compete with you.
Bingo.
Yeah, and, no, that makes a lot of sense.
Think about it from a business model standpoint, right? This market has to be really big for them to want to go and take a piece of it. And I think just in the reality, especially if you look at kind of pretty sophisticated defensive techniques, they want to enable those far, far, far before they want to go and compete in those markets. And I'm glad they're enabling it. That's the right answer.
One of the things you wanted to talk about was the fact that Gartner has now sprung up this, you know, network detection and response category. How much of a difference do you think that's going to make to your sector? Because look, as much as it irritates me, Gartner are actually pretty influential.
They absolutely are. And I think For the type of organizations we work with, it's a non-event because they don't generally look to Gartner. They've got very big security engineering teams. They're on the cutting edge of what's happening anyway. But if you know, I think of kind of the enterprises having three broad-based segments. You've got the really high and sophisticated folks that are driving absolute risk down to zero, right? Those are the folks we work with a lot. You've got kind of a lower end set of folks that are only allowed to buy what is needed for compliance, in which case they're just stuck, right? It doesn't matter what Gartner says. But the folks in the middle that are doing the best they can with the dollars they have, they pay a lot of attention to Gartner because they need that efficiency, right? They need somebody kind of doing the first level of homework for them. And I think in that middle sector, it's going to make a big difference, right? Because those are the folks where they need to know that the category is real before they start putting their credibility and their time, frankly, on the line with their management team. So I think that's the place where it's really going to help the market. So I'm glad that Gartner's coming out and kind of blessing the category at this point.
Yeah, it makes a difference when you can put that on a slide deck and present it to the higher ups, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's the old nobody got fired for buying IBM, right?
Yeah, but they did in Australia because IBM keeps screwing up major projects. So I'd hope that they did, given all of the stuff IBM has screwed up. But Brian Dye, it's been a real pleasure to chat to you. And I hope we could do it again one day. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Patrick. Been a long time listener. Love the show.
That was Brian Dye of Corelight there with a chat about all things NDR. I really enjoyed that one. You can probably tell. Brian told me too after the interview that he didn't mean the Microsoft return date comment to actually sound like this. Just so you all know. That is it for this week's show. It is great to be back in front of the mic. I'll be back later this week with a special Soapbox edition featuring Yubico's Chief Solutions Officer, Jared Chong. That's kind of turned into a bit of an annual institution, that one. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.